organizers. Really appreciate the opportunity to come and present some work, really kind of an overview of things I've been involved with over the last year or two. And my apologies to the condensed matter physicists in the audience who probably heard this talk, sometimes multiple times perhaps, but I think some of the things in here might be useful for those in the quantum information field. So what I want to focus on are gapless spin liquids in two dimensions, which are really, in some sense, the most challenging quantum phases that one can imagine trying to describe. Much more complicated than the topological states. So more specifically, I want to focus on quantum phases then of two-dimensional electrons or spins with emergent rather than broken symmetries. So a symmetry is not going to play a very important role here. I mean, ultimately, these quantum ground states that one is going to be interested in are dynamically generated. It's really the dynamics and which leads to sometimes emergent symmetries, but the original microscopic models have precious little symmetry to deal with. To be pedantic, I'm going to just start with a very quick lightning review of the quantum theory of solids, since we're interested in electrons in solids, metals and band insulators, and distinguish a band insulator from a mod insulator, which is really the focus of the talk, and then tell you what I mean by a quantum spin liquid in this context, and then focus in on the gapless spin liquids. So electrons in solids are naively extremely complicated. We have 10 to the 23 strongly interacting particles. And as I say, very little symmetry that one can appeal to. But the simplicity that can emerge is a big separation of energy scales for the electrons. So in particular, both the kinetic energy and the Coulomb interaction energy between the electrons are of order an electron volt, or 10 to the 4th Kelvin. So room temperature, as far as electrons in solids, is cold. And of course, one can, in the lab, lower the temperature much below room temperature. And then one has a huge separation of energy scales. And if one thinks in terms of rescaling down to low energies and long length scales and following the effective parameters in the model under sort of a renormalization group framework, as one scales down from the electron volt scale to down through room temperature, one can end up in a stable, possibly stable zero temperature quantum phase, which is described by a zero temperature fixed point. And universality can then emerge. So the quantum theory of solids has two dominant phases, metals and band insulators, which correspond in band theory to having an odd number of electrons per unit cell, or in the simplest band insulators, an even number of electrons per unit cell. And of course, band theory, where this comes from, is just a very simple model of electrons not interacting with one another, moving in a periodic potential, which gives one block states and energy bands. And the band insulators are states where the bands are filled. The metals, the upper band is partially filled. And as I say, the usual rule of thumb is that if there's an even number of electrons per unit cell, when it's dealing with the band insulator, the top band is filled and the electrons are inert. An odd number of electrons per unit cell, when band theory would always predict one has a metal. But band theory is wrong in many, many instances. And in fact, it's wrong in sort of half the materials. So if you look at the electrons near the Fermi energy, the uppermost energetic electrons, in materials in which those electrons come from atomic D or F shells, and materials with an odd number of electrons per unit cell, they generically are not metals. One has strong Coulomb repulsion between the electrons, and they get stuck on their respective atoms. And so a system with an odd number of electrons per unit cell, which is insulating rather than metallic, is what we call a Mott insulator. And this is after Sir Neville Mott. So the quantum phases of electrons, we have an odd number of electrons per unit cell, where the electrons are from atomic s or p orbitals, takes one to a metal. An even number of electrons per unit cell takes one to a band insulator, typically. And an odd number of electrons per unit cell coming from atomic d or f orbitals usually takes one into a mod insulator state. Now, a mod insulator as far as the charge physics is concerned, is trivial. The electrons are stuck on their atoms and are not moving. And what's interesting is the spin degrees of freedom and what the spins are doing. And the basic toy model that we all know and love is the Hubbard model with one electron per site. And in the limit that the repulsive interaction between the electrons, the on-site U, is larger than the kinetic energy, one can map into an effective spin one-half model where one has usually the lowest order term in the Heisenberg spin model is just S dot S. But as we're going to see, as far as the dynamics is concerned of these simple spin models, higher order terms are going to play an absolutely critical role in leading to interesting spin liquid states. So these spin models have precious little symmetry. The only global symmetry is an SU2 spin symmetry, and then there are discrete lattice point and space group symmetries. And what we're really interested in is dynamics of trying to understand the ground states of these spin models, and in general, you know, which are interacting quantum many body systems. Now, often in real materials, in real mod insulators, what happens is one gets symmetry breaking and a doubling of the U in itself. So mod insulators often try to become band insulators. So if you start with mod insulators with one electron per unit cell, it will, under some situations, many situations in many materials, will double its unit cell and, as I say, morally become a band insulator. The classic example is the two-dimensional square lattice antiferromagnet. So that's uninteresting. So mod insulators, when they break symmetry, is not so interesting. And it, you know, it's one can understand those broken symmetry states using an order parameter description. What's more interesting, though, is when a mod insulator doesn't break any symmetries. And that's what we call a spin liquid, a quantum spin liquid. So a two-dimensional quantum spin liquid is a mod insulator, that is an insulating material with one electron per unit cell, or spin model, spin a half model per unit cell, with no broken symmetries. And it turns out if you have such a two-dimensional spin liquid, the remarkable implication, which follows from a beautiful theorem by Matt Hastings, is that such two-dimensional spin liquids come in two flavors: topological spin liquids on the one hand and gapless spin liquids on the other hand. This theorem basically, for those of you who don't know, tells you that for a system on an L by L torus, if it has at least a continuous U1 symmetry, the difference between the energy of the first excited state and the ground state vanishes in the thermodynamic limit. So naively, you would say that this theorem is saying that there are gapless excitations, but it's possible to have low energy excitations of the topological character coming from a ground state degeneracy when one puts a system on a torus. Okay, so two-dimensional spin liquids, no broken symmetries, and one has topological spin liquids and the gapless spin liquids, which we'll see often have emergent symmetries. So topological spin liquids are time-reversible analogs of the fractional quantum Hall effect states. Generically, they will have, although don't have to, a gap to all bulk excitations. And the important point about these topological spin liquids or topological quantum states in general, and the reason for the title topological, is that there will be ground state degeneracies when the model is put on a manifold of non-trivial topology. So in particular, on a true torus, for example. And in the topological spin liquids, one typically has fractional quantum numbers arising for the particle-like excitations above the gap, for example, excitations which carry spin one half, which are not present in an ordered state of in one of the ordered states of a mod insulator. And the simplest such topological spin liquid is a short-range RVB state, which has an emergent Z2 gauge structure. And the effective field theory which describes this is very similar to Kateyev's toric code, which basically, as we heard yesterday, is, from Guifer, is very closely related to Z2 gauge theory. Unfortunately, as far as physics is concerned, we don't have a single example yet of a physically reasonable SU2 spin model with a topological spin liquid ground state. And if we don't have reasonable looking examples, theoretically, it's unlikely we're going to find examples experimentally. But you know, sometimes experiments are richer than and smarter than we are.
And they argue that if you decorate the system with more spins, you could essentially tune the overlaps to become very small. And so it would be more or less like a dynamo. Will that not qualify for that? I mean, it's a rather artificial model, I think.
But well, it's physically reasonable.
Well, this is too invariant.
No, I know, but that's why I put
it. It is.
So that's a nice example of a proof of principle. You can have an SU2 spin model with a Z2 topological structure.
That's quite likely to have.
Okay, is that based on numerics?
There is, I guess, some preliminary numeric, but it's not convincing yet.
Okay, good. So maybe we can have some optimism.
But there are many models with UN symmetry.
What's that?
Maybe not SU2, but SG conserving.
There's models with XXZ symmetry.
These are physically reasonable.
Yeah, no, there's physically reasonable models with XXZ symmetry or U1 symmetry, which a number of people in this room have worked on, which exhibit topological spin liquid ground states. What I'm going to focus on are the gapless spin liquids, which are much more complicated and rich. So these are really remarkable quantum states of interacting spin models, which we believe are stable gapless phases with no broken symmetry. So Huber Hamiltonian, whose ground state goes into one of these gapless spin liquids, the belief is you can disturb or distort the Hamiltonian a little bit, move it around in Hamiltonian space, and stay in this phase. So it's actually a quantum phase, zero-temperature quantum phase. And I have to admit, at least I was skeptical that such quantum phases could even exist in principle until maybe the last 5 or 10 years. And these quantum spin liquids, even though they're gapless phases, the gaplessness is not coming from a broken symmetry or a Goldstone mode. They don't have any free particle description. So they're more like critical points in some sense, in which one has a strongly interacting theory with, as I say, no free particle description. There are Pavlov correlations generically with anomalous exponent, and they can have emergent symmetries at low energies. And the ones we know about of these stable gapless phases, one has lattice scale physics, which is manifest in the infrared. And that comes in that manifestation of the gaplessness in the infrared. The short length scale physics being manifest in the infrared comes when we look at the two classes of gapless spin liquids. After Shaogun, I think, named these first class algebraic spin liquids, in which the spin-spin correlation functions have Pavlov decays at a finite set of discrete momenta in the Brillouin zone. And so, the fact that let's say one's on the square lattice here, and the spin-spin correlation function is decaying at pi-pi, the lattice scale physics is entering into what the long-distance, real space, long-distance decay of a spin correlation function. Even richer than these algebraic spin liquids are phases which we take into calling spin Bose metals, in which spin correlation functions are singular along surfaces in momentum space. And so one might call these Bose surfaces, because the spin models are, bosonic models. The two spin operators commute on different sites. And these spin Bose metals are, as far as I know, the most complicated type of quantum ground states, which we hope can be generic stable phases that at least that I'm aware of. So two-dimensional spin liquids, topological spin liquids, and gapless spin liquids, and at least I'm subdividing these gapless spin liquids into the algebraic spin liquids in the spin rose metals. So just a brief guide as to where one might look for such gapless spin liquids in the land of Hamiltonian space. On the algebraic spin liquid, what we believe is a key ingredient is frustration. So having, for example, triangles or three spins antiferromagnetically coupled, low spin and low coordination number, having a few neighbors, like on the Kagame lattice. And there are a number of experimental systems, particularly this Herbert Smithide crystal, which is a spin 1/2 Kagame-based material, which seems to be showing evidence for some sort of gapless spin liquid, which I think presently we don't really understand. But it may well be one of these algebraic spin liquids. Where might we look for the spin Bose metals, the spin liquids with singular surfaces in momentum space? Well, there, based on physical reasoning, what we want to look at is systems in which this sort of quasi-itinerancy, in which the electrons can almost move around, and they're in a what one would call a weak bond insulator, or in the system in which the charge gap, the gap to excitations above the Hubbard U, if you will, are comparable to the exchange interaction between the electrons, between the spins, excuse me. There is a beautiful number of organic bond insulators, two in particular, which are triangular lattice-based, which we think might be giving us examples of such spin Bose metals. So what's the theoretical route to try to access these gapless spin liquids? Well, here's really where we are in want of new theoretical approaches. And the one that seems to be working, at least in some situations, is slave fermions. And the gauge theoretic description of slave fermions and the Goetz-Wheeler wave functions associated with slave fermions. So very briefly, for those of you who are not familiar with these slave fermion parton descriptions, what one does is write the spin operator in terms of two fermionic spinons with the constraint that there's exactly one spinon on each site. And then one writes down an effective Hamiltonian, a mean field Hamiltonian, in which these spinons, which really are just part of the spin, hop around on the lattice without any interactions with one another. So this is a really a rash approximation. And one thing it does is it takes one out of the Hilbert space of the original spin model. And so one fixes that by solving this trial Hamiltonian, which is a free fermion determinant, the wave function being just a quadratic fermion model. And then Goetz-Wheeler projects out doubly occupied and unoccupied sites to project into the subspace of a spin wave function. So the way one can think about that is one just writes out, let's say, a filled Fermi-C wave function in a configuration, a basis, where these are labeled the different sites. And one just takes the wave function and writes it out in this basis and throws away pieces of the wave function in which there's an empty site, or a doubly occupied site. And thereby arrive at a spin wave function. Another way to use the slave fermion approach, or another way to decide the Goetz-Wheeler projection, is using gauge theory by introducing these fermionic spinons. One's introduced a local redundancy, a gauge freedom, where one can multiply the spinon just by a phase on each site. And so one needs a gauge field in this effective Hamiltonian describing these spinons to eliminate the redundancy. And in many cases, that's one can argue that's a U1 gauge field. And this gauge field must be treated as a dynamical variable. So we believe that the effective field theory that one gets following this slave particle approach can consist of fermions hopping on the lattice, minimally coupled to a U1 gauge field, which has a Maxwell form, E squared plus a B squared. In general, it's going to be a compact gauge field. So there are many examples of fermionic spin-ons which depend on what one takes for these Tijs in this Hamiltonian. And Shaogan, beautiful paper back in 2001, classified the different types of such spin liquid using projective symmetry group ideas. So let me just give you an example. One example of an algebraic spin liquid, theoretically, is the so-called staggered flux state, which has been popular in the context of high-temperature superconductors. The mean field Hamiltonian, then, is just these spin-ons hopping on the lattice with staggered flux. And the band structure for that has four massless two-component Dirac fermions. And so the effective low-energy field theory is QED3 with, one can argue, a non-compact gauge field due to the suppression of monopoles because of the massless fermions that one has in the system, thereby avoiding Polyakov's confinement argument. And in such an algebraic spin liquid, and in particular in this one, there's a large emergent symmetry. The spin Hamiltonian that entered only had just a global SU2 spin symmetry. But the low energy effective field theory, which is non-compact QED3 with SU4 flavor symmetry and a U1 flux conservation symmetry. So it has an enhanced symmetry at low energies. It's not a symmetry breaking. It's an emergent symmetry. And this SU4 symmetry encodes various different slowly varying order parameters. And this U1 flux conservation symmetry encodes a conserved spin chirality. Let's see, how am I at the time? I 11:15, the quarter past, right? Yeah. So there's one I mentioned earlier, these organic materials, which we think might be candidate spin Bose metal materials. I don't want to talk about these materials very much, but just to say that they can be modeled as a triangular lattice Hubbard model at half filling, and that they are weak mod insulators. Under pressure, the spin liquid phase goes into a metallic state, so it's near the metal insulator transition, and they have many low energy excitations, in fact, more low energy excitations than in a metal. So let me focus in on a model which is appropriate for these organic materials, which is the Hubbard model on the triangular lattice, and see what progress we can make. So the phase diagram for the Hubbard model on the triangular lattice at half filling is just a function of one parameter, the ratio of the Hubbard U to the kinetic energy. And we understand this model in the two limits, very weak coupling and very strong coupling. A very weak coupling, one basically just has free fermions or weakly interacting fermions in a Fermi liquid metallic state. At very strong coupling, one can map the model to a Heisenberg model with nearest neighbor interactions, and that's believed to undergo a Nail ordered state. Somewhere in between this metal and this magnetically ordered insulator is a metal insulator transition. This is the Mott transition. And it's the physics in the vicinity of this Mott transition and intermediate coupling, which is really the bane of strongly correlated electrons, at least in the field of quantum magnetism. And what we're interested in the context of the spin Bose metal is a weak Mott insulator in the vicinity of this Mott transition, but on the insulating side. And when one looks there, the effective spin model, in addition to just having the Heisenberg nearest neighbor interaction, has other terms. In particular, an important term is a four-site term, which corresponds to a ring exchange, where one takes basically four electrons on four sites and rotates them by 90 degrees. And so these ring exchange terms mimic charge fluctuations in the system. So what is the appropriate Goetz-Wille wave function or spin liquid in a weak Mott insulator? Well, one can argue physically that when one has such a weak Mott insulator, there's a long charge correlation length, so that there'll be regions of the system in which the electron doesn't know whether it's in an insulator or a metal. And in some sense, the electron and the spinons are the same as one another, and that on shorter length scales than this charge correlation length. And so one can guess that the spin correlations inside this charge correlation will resemble the spin correlations of a free fermion metal, which oscillate at 2kF. So the appropriate spin liquid in a weak Mott insulator is a Goetz-Wöhler projected Fermi C. So one basically imagines just taking the Hubbard model on the triangular lattice, throwing away the Hubbard U, and then just taking the free fermion hopping with a Fermi filled Fermi C, and then Goetz-Wöhler projecting that filled Fermi C. And if you wanted a name for that, call that state spin Bose metal once you Goetz-Wöhler project. So what's the phenomenology of the spin Bose metal? Well, this is something established by many, many different people, and both from looking at the Goetz-Wöhler wave function and looking at the gauge theory. And what one finds is that there are 2kF singularities in something like the spin-spin correlation function. So in a free Fermi liquid, there's a slope discontinuity in the spin-spin correlator at 2kF. We believe that in the spin-Bose metal, after we do the Goetz-Wöhler projection, that these singularities are enhanced. And these 2kF singularities are the Bose surfaces that I was referring to. So in the triangular lattice spin Bose metal, one would have these blue 2kF Bose surfaces. But one can ask then, is the projected Fermi C a good caricature of the triangular lattice ring model? So here we write down this, the Heisenberg model plus ring exchange, Forsyte ring exchange. And we would like to try to analyze that. And here where one is faced with a theoretical quandary, which has been, the thing which really keeps us in business, which is that the numerical approaches we have just don't work in two dimensions. And quantum Monte Carlo has a sign problem in such frustrated spin models. Exact ionization is can only diagonalize very small systems, maybe up to 36 sites or so. Variation of Monte Carlo using these Goetz-Wöhler wave functions is biased. One builds in a particular wave function that one starts with, and in some sense one gets out what one puts in. And then DMRG, which is related to these matrix product states, is problematic in two dimensions, although in one dimension it works like a charm. And in fact, we're going to use that the fact that DMRG works like a charm in one dimension to try to access the spin Bose metal, and in particular try to access this Heisenberg plus ring exchange model on the triangular lattice by looking at quasi-one-dimensional ladders. And the key point here is the reason why this is an appropriate thing to be doing is that when one puts the two-dimensional model on a ladder, one quantizes the transverse momenta, the momentum in the y direction. And so in the two-dimensional Brillouin zone, one breaks it into a bunch of one-dimensional systems. Yeah, I think I've taken an n-leg ladder with n transverse momenta. And in the algebraic spin liquid, where the spin correlation functions are gapless at, let's say, commensurate and discrete points in the Brillouin zone, as one takes the width of the ladder wider, one doesn't intersect any more points than one already does, let's say, in the six-leg ladder. But in the spin Bose metal, where one has a Bose surface, then every time one adds a extra leg to the ladder, one will get an extra quantized the value of the transverse momenta and an extra quasi-one-dimensional mode. So basically, by putting a spin Bose metal with a Bose surface onto the quasi-one-dimensional ladder, one should see fingerprints of the two-dimensional singular surface showing up as many gapless one-dimensional modes of order n, where n is the number of legs in the ladder. And so what this tells us is that we expect a whole slew of new spin liquid phases on quasi-one-dimensional strips, each of which is a descendant of some putative two-dimensional Bose metal. Okay, so we've done, this is work with Donna Sheng and Lezik Mottramnich. They've done some beautiful numerical work on the simplest ladder, which is just the two-leg ladder, and taking the Heisenberg plus ring exchange One can view this two-leg ladder with, if we allow for different exchange interactions, J1 and J2, as a one-dimensional system, if one just squashes down this ladder, with a first neighbor interaction and a second neighbor interaction. Okay, so this one-dimensional system that we're going to be studying is just the J1, J2 Heisenberg chain, which is something that's well understood. But we're adding now a four-site ring exchange interaction. And the J1, J2 Heisenberg chain with a four-site interaction is something which hasn't been looked at until, you know, until the recent work here. So we're going to analyze this J1, J2 K model, with K as the ring exchange interaction, using Monte Carlo, DMRG, and bosonization. And let me just tell you a few of the results and a few of the puzzles and things we don't understand and things we do understand. So the Gutzwiller wave function that one writes down on this for the system is one just takes a trial, a Hamiltonian of the spin-ons having a first and second neighbor hopping. And when the second neighbor hopping is big enough, one has, in the band structure of these one-dimensional spin-ons, one has two bands. And so the free fermion determinant one builds up before doing the Gutzwiller projection is just two filled or two partially filled Fermi C bands. So one takes that slated determinant and Gutzwiller projects. And the important point here is that there's only a single variational parameter in this Gutzwiller wave function, which is basically the number of electrons, or number of spin-ons, excuse me, one puts into the second band. One's at half filling, so the total number of spin-ons is conserved. That is KF1 plus KF2 is equal to pi over 2. So this Gutzwiller wave function, we think, is a very, very special wave function. One can look at numerically the spin-spin correlation functions, which, as I say, oscillate at some finite wave vector and decay with a power law. And by doing very big system sizes with a variation of Monte Carlo on this Gutzwiller wave function, one can pull out an exponent, this exponent alpha, and one gets values consistent with 3/2. Now, 3/2 is the exponent one would expect if one had an SU4 spin chain at level 1. And the reason we think this is actually behaving like an SU4 spin chain, this ground state wave function, is that the 4 is coming from the fact that one has two bands and one has spin, and then the gauge field is projecting out the overall charge degree of freedom, breaking the system down from U4 to SU4. Now, in general, these velocities in these two bands would be different, but a wave function doesn't know about velocities. So when we do this Gutzwiller projection, we think that there's an enhanced asymmetry in the wave function, which takes one from an SU2 cross SU2 symmetry for the two bands and promotes that to an SU4 symmetry. And this suggests that there may be some analytic progress possible. The wave function can be written in terms of Schur polynomials. You know, I would like to think maybe matrix product states could be useful in trying to analyze some of these SUN spin chains. So what about the phase diagram, okay, which was established by DMRG? So this axis, when K, the ring is equal to 0, is just the J1, J2 model, and one has beta solution here at 0, which is just the gapless C equals 1 conformal field theory. And then above a value of around 1/4, one goes into the dimerized state, Fehlenz-Bond state 2. When one turns on this ring exchange interaction, one opens up a big region of the phase diagram, which is basically a phase diagram which is consistent with being in this spin Bose metal. I can talk about this BBS3 if anybody wants, but let me just ignore that for now. Okay, so I already mentioned the beta chain state and the VBS2 state, which I think are familiar perhaps states. So what about in the spin Bose metal region of the phase diagram? Well, one can look then at the spin-spin structure factor, and both with DMRG and by using this Gutzwiller projected Fermi C, where one filled up partially these two Fermi Cs. What one finds from the DMRG is that there are singularities at various different momenta, pi over 2, one labeled 2KF2, another labeled 2KF1. And the Gutzwiller wave function with only one variational parameter is this green dashed curve, which maybe you can't see very well. But it basically has singularities which line up exactly with the singularities from the solution of the model. So, so the singular momentum that show up in the DMRG solution of the model can be identified with the Bose surface that's implicit in this Gutzwiller wave function. So I really can't overemphasize how amazing this agreement is. When we saw it, we were kind of blown away. I mean, basically what's happening is one's taking this a spin model, and one's solving it with DMRG, and one's finding singular structure of the spin-spin correlation function in momentum space at a bunch of different momenta. And one is then taking a Gutzwiller wave function, which is basically just a free fermion determinant, and Gutzwiller projecting it, so one ends up with a spin model, and one finds the singularities are in exactly the same place as they are for the spin model. So the sine structure of the wave function in this spin model is very closely related to the sine structure of just free fermions.
KF1.
Yeah, so but the band structure was adjustable, but it was adjusted to minimize the energy. So there was one variational parameter which was chosen to minimize the energy in the Hamiltonian, and then one just calculates with variational Monte Carlo the Gutzwiller wave function, the correlation function is using the Gutzwiller wave function with that single parameter which is determined energetically, and then compares to DMRG. So in some sense, I mean, there's no fit parameters, if you will. I mean, it's just one variational parameter. But really, it is quite surprising. You can look at, as you move around in the phase diagram, you can look at the motion of these singular structures in momentum space. And I guess I won't belabor the point here, but just what happens is that the singular 2KFs that come from the Gutzwiller projected Fermi C state track the singularities that one sees in the DMRG as one moves throughout the spin Bose-Mennel state. And we've heard a lot about entanglement, and I've talked a little bit about emergence. So let me talk about an entanglement in this spin Bose-Mennel state. So to try to make a prediction as to how entangled we think this state is, one can use bosonization, bosonizing this one-dimensional gauge theory. I already mentioned one basically has two bands and spin, so one has four flavors of fermions. And then when one does the gauge projection, one eliminates one of those gapless modes and gets a description in terms of three gapless modes. So this is a fixed point description of this spin Bose-Mennel on the zigzag chain. And the three gapless modes, two of them can be understood as basically looking like two spin chains. But those spin chains are coming from bands, they're not one chain and the other chain. And the third gapless mode can be understood as a gapless mode describing the spin chirality, which is really the gauge flux in this gauge theory. So again, one has some emergent global symmetries here, SU2 cross SU2, and then there's a U1 spin chirality. But as far as the entanglement entropy is concerned, one has a effective fixed point theory of the spin Bose-Mennel, which has just three gapless modes. So the central charge should be C equals 3. So one can then try to measure the central charge with DMRG. And Donna Sheng has done that, looking at the entanglement entropy, looking at a subsystem of length x in a system with periodic boundary conditions of length L. And there's this formula we've seen a number of times already, where the central charge C enters. This is a rather busy slide. Just focus on the lowest curve and the upper curve. The lowest curve is the Heisenberg chain, where C, the central charge, is equal to 1. And that fits very nicely, this expression here with central charge 1. On the other hand, in the spin Bose-Mennel state, it fits extremely nicely to a central charge of 3. So you know, we're dealing with this DMRG and we're dealing with this Goodswiller wave function. The Goodswiller wave function cannot tell us about dynamics. It's just telling us about equal time correlation functions. And so, you know, the effective field theory tells us how many gapless modes we have, but we had no way to access the number of gapless modes without using this notion of entanglement entropy to try to pull out the central charge. So it was extremely useful. And I should say that in these, when we have these three gapless modes, the velocities are different. So you know, we don't really have a conformal field theory. We have, in some sense, three copies of conformal field theories with different speeds of light. But the wave function, the entanglement entropy, which is a property of the ground state wave function, it knows nothing about velocity. So it just adds up the central charges of these three gapless bosonic modes, even though they each have different velocity. And so we're moving on to the four-leg triangular ladder. This is work in progress. So we take the four-leg triangular lattice and put the Heisenberg nearest neighbor Hamiltonian with a four-site ring exchange on this triangular lattice. And the preliminary results, which I won't belabor, again show that the spin-spin correlation function is showing singularities which are consistent with the Goodswiller wave function. So again, the Goodswiller wave function, we have some variational parameters. In this case, we have three bands, basically. So there's variational parameters, which is, you know, there's two variational parameters. But those variational parameters are determined energetically, once again, in the wave function. And then the DMRG and the Goodswiller wave function show singularities at the same value of momenta. So as far as the effective field theory is concerned, we have three-band spin-on Fermi C wave function. And so three bands plus times two for spin gives one six gapless modes. And the gauge constraint takes that down to five gapless modes. So for this three-band, this four-leg triangular lattice, we expect that the central charge would be five. Now, Donna Shang with her DMRG is trying to pull out the central charge. But when the central charge gets as big as five, it becomes extremely challenging because the system is very entangled. And she keeps increasing the number of states she keeps that are keeping in the DMRG. And entanglement entropy progressively is going up and up and up. But she's having trouble getting beyond a central charge of four. So it's very, very entangled state. In a minute. And so just further comment or two on the entanglement entropy. We believe, based on these Goodswiller wave functions and the effective field theory, that when you have an n-leg ladder, if you take a length L segment of the n-leg ladder, that the entanglement entropy will go as log L, of course, because one has n gapless modes. One has C gapless modes, but C sub n is going to be proportional to n. So the number of bands that one has and the number of one-dimensional gapless modes is going to scale with the number of legs in the ladder. And so in two dimensions, the two-dimensional spin Bose metal state, which is a Goodswiller projecting a two-dimensional Fermi C, there we would expect in an L by L region that the entanglement entropy goes as L log L. So that is a two-dimensional spin Bose metal is as entangled, probably more entangled, as the free Fermi C. But as we know, at least when we're trying to understand the free Fermi C in real space, it's one of the most challenging states. And so the spin Bose metal state, I think, is going to be very, very challenging for matrix product states and tensor product state approaches. So let me just end with the challenge. I mean, two-dimensional gapless spin liquids are highly entangled, and there's no free particle description, so it has these stable gapless phases, which are basically critical phases. And these Goodswiller wave function approaches seem to be, working rather well, but it's not the full story, certainly. And what's really needed are new non-perturbative approaches, new variational wave functions, as many in the audience are constructing. perhaps tensor product states or generalizations thereof. And we've seen that this quasi one-dimensional route offers a particular window into the two-dimensional Spinbose metal by looking at these quasi one-dimensional descendant states which exist on the ladders. So this field of gapless spin liquids is wide open and extremely challenging theoretically, but we need bright young people coming into this field with ideas, and it seems like that's what we have going on in this conference. So I think that bodes very well for the future. Anyway, thanks for your attention.
The U1 gate field is actually 2D, and it's a four-leg ladder. I wonder whether there's possibility to have a two-gauge field rather than one. I'm trying to explain why you get a four rather than five, or whether there's some.
Yeah, I mean, basically because of the, it's got a finite width.
Yeah.
One has the transverse gauge. The transverse photons are gapped out, and really at long length scales, it looks just one-dimensional. And so one can choose a particular gauge and just work with a scalar potential in fact. As one approaches two dimensions, that becomes a worse and worse approximation, clearly. You know, if you're a 10-leg ladder, treating it as 10 Luddinger of liquids, or nine Luddinger of liquids is not going to be very good, because there's going to be, two-dimensional photons which are moving up and down the ladder. So while this trick of looking on the quasi-one-dimensional systems gives us a way to look at the sign structure of the wave function and gives us evidence for the existence of these Bose surfaces in the two-dimensional state, we're not going to be able to access with DMRG, I don't think, critical properties of the two-dimensional spin Bose metal, such as the exponents and how they vary around these Bose surfaces, which we might like to be able to do. So it's it certainly has its limitations.
I have a comment. I think in the quasi 1D limit, at least in narrow strips like this, the gauge theory picture is not very useful, because gauge theories in 1 plus 1 dimensions don't have local degrees of freedom, simply because of the kinematics of 1D. And so may well emerge in the limit where the strips are wide, but in the limit where you just simply have a two-leg ladder, this is probably just these collective modes have, if you wish, a different physical meaning than the gauge theory may actually suggest. So they're ultra-confining in a sense.
Well, of course, that's right. So one doesn't actually need to use the term. One doesn't need to use the gauge here. In fact, one can take a Hubbard model and put in enough Ford scattering interactions that various Umklapp scattering processes, which are irrelevant to weak coupling, like 6-fermion Umklapp scattering processes, have become relevant. And the main, and which gap out the overall charge mode. So that's the gauge field. The only thing it's doing is it's taking the linear confining potential on the overall gauge charge and gapping out that mode. You're entirely right. Or maybe one can even use that language.
I mean, they may well emerge in the limit when you go to two dimensions,
it is interesting, though, that in two dimensions, the gauge flux is spin chirality.
Yes.
And here, the spin chirality is encoded not in the gauge flux, but in the boson.
Right.
Okay, so, that's what it is. What it is, but that's kind of curious. Thanks.
There was a recent Monte Carlo paper on the Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice.
Yeah.
Claiming to see a spin liquid phase at intermediate U. Do you have any comments on what kind of phase that might be or how it fits into your classification?
Well, my understanding is that there aren't many it doesn't look like there are many low energy excitations there, and so
everything's gapped, and saying there's no topological.
I mean, there are 2 electrons per unit cell, so it's not actually completely obvious to me that there couldn't be a unique paramagnetic state. But
My intuition actually somehow tells me that that's not the case. I mean, that might be actually something would be useful to try to look at, you know, someone who's more mathematically inclined than I am, you know, to try to argue one way or the other whether a, you know, a spin 1/2 model on the honeycomb lattice can have a unique paramagnetic ground state. If it can't, then, you know, perhaps one's dealing with some one of these Z2 spin liquids. But I don't have any.
But that's not the Heisenberg model. That's
it's Hubbard model, yeah. But it's in the insulating state that.
Well, it's
I mean, there's a.
It's at the intermediate coupling, so it's hard to.
It's an intermediate coupling, which is, but it's in the insulating state, and it's a weak mod insulator, so yeah. There's probably ring exchange interactions which are important there as well, you know, for the appropriate spin model. Nevertheless, it is. There should be some spin model with finite range interactions, which is appropriate, which would, you know, describe in principle the universal spin properties of that, you know, that putative phase that they're finding numerically.
Thanks so much, then.